Good morning and welcome to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is now at the controls. Today's most important avenues for sharing information, the internet and social networking services, things like Twitter, have become very important tools for political activists in this country and also around the world. And in fact, one only has to look at the recent anti-government protests in Iran to see how important this is in developing countries. Well, this morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll try to explore the impact of new information technologies on political communication, particularly in developing nations. And we have as our guests here two guests. Joining us by telephone, both of them. Our first guest, Philip Howard, is an associate professor in the Department of Communication at University of Washington in Seattle. He is also a fellow at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University. And he certainly has done a lot of writing about these kinds of new information technologies and what they have meant for politics here in the United States. But he is also interested in how these technologies are being used to solve social problems in developing countries as well. Our other guest is Helga Tawil-Sori. She is an assistant professor of culture and communication at New York University. And among her interests are media technologies and cultural expressions, especially contemporary media production and reception, and how that relates to economic and political change in the Middle East. One of her projects, something that she's working on right now, in fact, involves a project looking at internet development in the Palestinian territories. She's also done research on Arab and Palestinian broadcasting industries and cinema, and she is also a photographer and documentary filmmaker. So as we talk, questions are welcome. We ask people who are calling in, please, to keep your questions brief, and we ask that so we can keep things moving along and get in as many different people as possible. And please do keep your question focused on the topic. But certainly participation by listeners, that's welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions are certainly welcome. Well, we say hello to our guests. Professor Howard, hello.
Hello.
And Professor Tawil-Sori. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, fine. Thanks. Thanks very much for joining us. This may be one of the first bi-coastal shows I think I've done. I can't remember a time when we had two guests and they were so far apart. Anyway, I appreciate both of you giving us some of your time. Just as a way to start, and this is something that we've talked about before, and maybe it goes without saying, but I'll just turn here first to Philip Howard and to talk about a little bit about politics in the United States, and how the use of the internet and social networking, things like Facebook, things like Twitter, the fact that so many people have some kind of device with them all the time that they can use to communicate with others, that they can get messages, that learning to use those things for political activists here in the United States, really, they've been great tools, and I suppose you could say, without fear of contradiction, that it's changed the landscape of American politics. Yes?
Certainly, yes. Yeah. There's been some big changes over the last 10 years, and I think the two most important ones I see are somewhat contradictory in the sense that one of the big changes, as you say, is that activists and publics now have access to information technologies that make it possible to activate groups in ways that you just couldn't do even 10, 15 years ago. The other side of this, however, is that the tools that allow social networking also allow for social control. Mm-hmm. So politicians also have much better resources for manipulating public opinion. And one of the things we've seen consistently since 2000, 2004, again in 2008, is that these tools are very powerful tools for lobbyists. You have a piece of legislation you want to push through Congress, you use these same tools that the social activists use to get your legislation through. Same thing is true for candidates. They make good use of the tools just as well as the social activists do.
Here, well, let me turn to Professor Tawil-Sori, and that's something that I think it's really a fundamental point, something that's really interesting, and particularly if you look at those places where the governments exercise a little greater control than the United States does, whether the kind of IT tools that we're talking about here, are they primarily tools of expression or are they tools of repression?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that they are actually very much both, as Phil was mentioning, right? They are definitely tools of expression, and I think one of the things to keep in mind is to question expression for whom, especially in, if you want to call them developing nations, who actually has access to those kinds of technologies. They're not often those who are marginalized even within those societies. So it's a little problematic to even talk about expression as a whole. And they are, of course, they can be used as tools of repression, as we've seen in the case of Iran just not too long ago, where you can just sort of turn off the technology almost at will and kind of prevent people from accessing each other. The one other thing to keep in mind, I think, is also that it's not simply tools for governments, but I think also tools for IT companies as well. That they end up benefiting from this kind of use as well.
What about you seem to be talking about, we talk a lot about digital divide, even in and we see it everywhere, we see it here, even though the penetration of these technologies, like the cell phone, for example, is very high a lot of places around the world. It's still the case that if you look at some place, for example, the Middle East where you have studied, or some place like Iran, or maybe even some place, any other place we could name, that the people who have access to these technologies, that there still are important limitations, and in a sense, they are the elites of whatever society we're talking about?
I think more often than not. I mean, there are certainly, if we look at the Middle East, there are certainly a number of projects that try to make, say, internet available to women, to children, to refugees, to those who tend to be sort of on the margins of society. But overall, those users of whether it's cell phones or certainly things like Twitter and Facebook or laptops or internet tend to be those that are better off economically and usually then also have kind of stronger connections to the kind of political powers that be in those specific places.
Mm-hmm. Let me turn here to Professor Howard. Can you say something? I guess I'm just curious to have a little bit more about how, say, in the non-industrialized world, what you can say about access to things like access to the internet, and then all of those things that you can do with the internet.
Well, it's definitely true that the poorest segments of societies in the developing world don't have internet access. It's even though it's largely an elite tool in the developing world, that's still important because it's usually those elites that support or defect from an authoritarian regime. So it's in terms of the history of development, the internet arrived first at the universities, and then it tended to come through major multinational firms. You know, the oil company will bring in the latest technologies, and the employees will get internet access through work. And those folks tend to be the wealthiest segment of society, but they're also the ones who will give up on an authoritarian regime. And in terms of the structure of opportunity for revolutions, elite defection is really important. If your elites continue to buy into a tough dictator, allowing a tough dictator to rule the country, then the dictatorship is strong. If they use the technologies to learn about alternatives, if the young people in particular learn about what freedom is like in other countries or other ways of putting faith and freedom together in democratic institutions, then those visions for alternatives, those alternatives are clear to the elites who could change things.
Mm-hmm. Let me again here, I'll turn back to Helga Tawil-Suri. I'm just interested in the kind of things that you've seen where now we're to the point where it is possible for people to have access to tools that you can make and disseminate media, and the tools are relatively easy to use, and they can be I'm sure for a lot of people they're not affordable, but they're more affordable than they used to be. And while it maybe takes some level of experience and sophistication to be able to use them, they are more user friendly. And in what ways have you seen people using these things, particularly in the Middle East, where you have made some study of this?
Well, I'll give you a couple of examples from the Palestinian territories, which are obviously sort of a very politically rife kind of location. There are, for example, without even talking about the internet, there are different kinds of nonprofit organizations that give video cameras to different groups of Palestinians in order to film themselves and their interactions. I'm going to call them interactions with, like, settlers and Israeli police, so that whenever violence sort of erupts, that Palestinian farmers or Palestinians in general can kind of film these as a sort of testimony of the kinds of experiences that they go through. So that's one example, and that's not necessarily, quote-unquote, new media, right? Mm-hmm. You do obviously have, say, the creation of video games in which, you know, the younger generation can now play video games in which, this may not be a great thing, but in which they can shoot in the opposite direction so that they're not simply shooting at Arabs or Muslim terrorists, but they can actually shoot the other way around, right, in the sort of shoot 'em up games. Or they can kind of experience sort of virtual reality, but taking place in the Middle East, whether it's in Lebanon or the Palestinian territories. So those are just a couple of examples of some of the things that are actually happening today.
How here again, I'll turn back to Phil. How difficult or how easy is it for people today to not only to, in a sense, document their experience, but then be able to get that out? As I think that one of the challenges that if you're an opposition group within a country, you know, one of the challenges that you're going to face is having a voice and not only being able to talk to other people, like-minded people in your country, but to be able to tell people outside of your country about what's going on. And again, this was one of the things that we saw in Iran, where the media essentially were tossed out. And so the coverage we were getting was from people who were in the streets who were saying, look, here's what's going on, and finding a way to get that message not only around Iran, but outside of Iran. Mm-hmm. And what sort of roadblocks do people face, as I'm certain that governments do what they can to try to prevent that kind of message from getting out?
Well, you've hit on several points there about what has really changed and about the system of political communication in developing countries. And I think the first one there is that it's one of the nice things about internet infrastructure is that it's possible to put your content outside the control of the state. So, for example, in Azerbaijan, when the students at major universities disagree with something that's put over the state-run media, they will clip segments of the nightly newscast and put them on YouTube, but do their own voiceovers with these talking heads, the usual characters that say things that have been scripted for them by government propaganda writers. The students will come up with their own, what they see as the real news. And because this content lies outside the control of the government, it's there for Azeris, usually, who live overseas, to be able to catch up on what's going on at home. In the case of Iran, what's interesting is that the state will often try its best to shut down these new information technologies. So they'll try to stop the Twitter feeds, and they'll disable cell phone access from towers within Tehran or Isfahan. But some of the more clever social movement leaders will often have workarounds that let them get around these censorship tactics. And some of the most tech-savvy activists actually learn from each other. So they'll learn from the example of protests that occurred in another city a year prior about things you can do when the state actually does shut down the cell phone towers in your city. And often these fields that pick up mobile phone communications overlap enough that if the government shuts down the top two or three providers, there's a fourth provider or a provider in a neighboring city that actually picks up some signal. And so a tech-savvy activist will figure things out that still let them get messages out to the broader world. Mm.
Very quickly, let me again introduce the guests for this part of Focus 580. Philip Howard is Associate Professor in the Department of Communication at University of Washington in Seattle. Helga Tawil-Suri is Assistant Professor of Culture and Communication in the Department of Media, Culture and Communication at New York University. And we're talking here in part about how new media and information technologies are being used to do political communication We've certainly touched on that in the United States, and in other programs we've done that. But here particularly you want to kind of talk about what's happening outside of the United States and in other non-industrial countries. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller here to bring into the conversation on our toll-free line in the community of Belgium, not the country, but the community, which is not too far away from us, here on line four. Hello.
Hello. Good morning to you all. I know you want to speak about outside of the country, but I would like to have you address a little topic. You know, the founding fathers set up our Constitution with a certain way to empower the people to vote and carry on our government. And over the years, that's changed quite a bit from different ways we've communicated, way money influences, way we've decided not to have landed gentry as the only voters, way we allowed women to vote and all the ethnic groups. This change that we're going into now with all the money and the lobbyists and all the new technology of how we're dealing with our elections, isn't that really grating against our Constitution in some ways? Or maybe we should change it or something?
Well, I see if our guest has something to say. Well, Professor Howard, we'll let you take the best, the first shot.
Well, that it's a good question, because one of the things that is new for many political actors is the richness of data about voters. So your credit card records generate an enormous amount of politically valuable information, and the founding fathers certainly had no vision of credit card records, much less the data mining. And I suspect that one thing that we could do in this country would be to regulate the political uses of data mining in more careful ways. For example, if you buy contraceptives or guns or bullets and you put those things on your credit cards, there are lobby associations that will want to buy that data and try to reach out to you. And I think that the politicization of personal data that's happened in the United States and other advanced countries is going to come to the developing world. So countries such as Malaysia or Indonesia, which are actually fairly strong, stable democracies, they've each had a couple of decent elections in the last few years, I suspect that data mining will become a political tool in those countries over the next few years.
Is that getting at your...
Exactly. It just the aspect that maybe we have to change our rules. That's what I'm getting at. Does it seem like that should have to be?
Well, I have to admit that I'm Canadian, so I would change lots of things in the American Constitution.
Thank you very
much. All right, thank you. Professor Atewil-Suri, I don't know if you wanted to add anything?
In terms of changing the rules, I don't know if it's the sort of Constitution that necessarily needs changing to respond to IT changes. But perhaps, as Phil said, to kind of make sure that certain kinds of privacies or freedoms are still valued.
All right, let's talk with someone here in our community on line one. This is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I have a question about to what extent is ham radio and ham radio operators involved in this modern communication scheme. I'll hang up and listen off air.
Well, that's interesting. I don't know if that's something that either of you have looked at or know about. Have amateur radio operators been doing some of these kinds of things that now we're talking about people doing just with their cell phones or with their computers?
If I may.
Yes.
Radio happens to be still the most popular form of media across the Middle East. So certainly in that part of the world, and I would guess to say that in many other parts of the world where, you know, computers are more expensive, television is still kind of more expensive, radio tends to be one of the easiest things to use, right? You don't need to read. You just need to turn it on. You need some batteries or some power, and there you go. So certainly radio is popular. Now, whether or not ham radio is, I don't know if you want to call them ham radio operators, but there does exist a number of those. Again, and you know, my knowledge sort of is limited to the Middle East, but there are a number of players who you can call ham radio kind of operators, in which they set up kind of their towers on top of their houses or on top of their office buildings and broadcast and broadcast out. This is actually rampant across the Palestinian territories, where a lot of radio stations as well as TV stations are actually run in this way as well, not just radio. Unfortunately, a lot of them, what they're most interested in is kind of like pop music or music videos or kind of entertainment. So it's not necessarily for political purposes as much as it is for entertainment purposes, their listeners are more interested in kind of listening to the latest songs, not necessarily expressing political dissent.
Well, that's interesting. This is something different rather than what the caller was talking about. This is more like pirate stations, essentially. It's not a very complicated thing to set up your own radio station and then just start broadcasting, and you then, for people to receive your station, they wouldn't have to have any particularly special kind of equipment. As long as they had a radio, they could just be able to turn it on, and if they found your frequency and listen to what you were broadcasting.
Yeah, precisely.
Let me invite other people to call. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. We are close to our midpoint. This is Focus 580. My name is David Inge, and we're talking about new media and information technologies, what they mean for political communication, particularly in developing countries. Again, we have two guests with us, joining us by telephone, both of them. Helga Tawilsuri is assistant professor in the Department of Media, Culture and Communication at New York University, and Philip Howard is associate professor in the Department of Communication at University of Washington, Seattle. I'm just interested, Professor Tawilsuri, in your thoughts about what we have seen in Iran. It's not the first instance we've seen, I think, of people doing this kind of thing, using cell phones to take pictures and then posting them on the internet, blogging, communicating what's going on, using that to get information out and so forth. It seems that in this particular case, though, it got more attention somehow, and I'm not exactly sure why.
Well, maybe because the BBC was kicked out at some point. I think that we have this sort of love affair with technology, that we want it to be this kind of powerful tool for revolutions, and so that any time it pops up anywhere, I think we like to focus on that. I think in the case of Iran, though, there is a way in which having had limited media come from elsewhere, that this was kind of the one outlet that we all kind of focused on. I mean, I myself tried to follow what was going on through through Twitter and so on, and found it actually kind of very frustrating, because I couldn't tell who it was that was sending these messages. And I mean, I know that a lot of my activist friends here in the U.S. were saying, oh, you know, use Twitter so that they being the sort of Iranian government, can't tell where those messages are coming from and who's sending them. So that there is a way in which, while on the one hand it can be very helpful in political communication, you also don't often know who's actually behind those kinds of messages. Is it somebody in Iran, or is it my neighbor down the street here in New York?
Does that, Professor Howard, somehow make things more clear or more confusing?
Well, I think it makes it, you're right, there's some potential for anonymity in these technologies, but a lot of these technologies, especially the social networking, the ones that have aspects involved in social networking, allow for identity formation that maintains people's associations across transnational boundaries. So, for example, in Illinois, you have a professor, Lisa Nakamura, at the University of Urbana-Champaign. And she's got a book called Cybertypes, in which she argues that the key thing for new technologies is how young people begin to make their political identities online. And in the case of Iran, these technologies have been very useful in connecting the Iranian diaspora to what's going on in-country. Now, it used to be that the Iranians in Los Angeles would produce their own radio programs and television programs for that community. And now there's many different individuals, both in the diaspora and in LA, and in other parts of the world, producing content digitally that's consumed in Iran. And then there are Iranians who are producing personal content online that gets consumed by this diaspora. So the technologies have allowed people to maintain and even reconnect with family members, friends and family that they had lost connections with over the years.
Mm. I just wonder, just to cite the example of Iran and how much we made of the use of these kind of technologies, and it seemed that people were talking a lot about Twitter, and I'm sure that the folks at Twitter thought this was great because people were talking about Twitter. But whether we were overemphasizing the importance of these technologies, or maybe we were getting it just right and it's something that we hadn't appreciated as much in the past, or maybe mainstream media hadn't taken as much notice as they should have.
Well, I think particular firms benefit whenever their technology is identified as something that's playing a role in democratic change. I guess as a scholar, I'm more interested in the mechanisms of change and trying to tie an argument to blogging or to a particular blogger software or to Twitter particularly is less powerful than trying to build an argument from the properties of the technology. And Twitter is an interesting example because Twitter was in the news only 2 months prior for a revolution, a set of protests that occurred in Moldova that turned out to be state-manipulated. So for a while in the news reports, there were stories of students in Moldova using Twitter to coordinate a mass action, but it turned out it was the state using Twitter to bring in Romanian students to protest against greater inclusion in Europe. And the story became very convoluted, but it was not clear that it was democratic activists using Twitter to improve the political process in their country. It was probably an example of the state using Twitter to manipulate people.
Yeah, well, that goes back to something we were talking about a little bit earlier, that it's possible for states and for governments to do that. They can use the tools as well as individuals can, and perhaps, again, underscores the point that Professor Tewil-Suri made about the fact that, well, you know, you don't always know what the source of the information is and who it is that's saying this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, let's take another caller here. We have someone in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello, good morning.
Yes.
So this is kind of a contrast to maybe repressive regimes like Iran, but I want to talk about kind of new media in democracies in general.
Sure.
So it seems that new media leads to kind of media fragmentation almost by definition, and that from confirmation bias, people tend to seek support for their own views and then seek out media that supports that. And as a result, you have kind of people with their own narratives about what is going on in society, and then that leads to a difficulty coming up with consensus and difficulty just in having a functioning democracy where people agree on the basic facts of what's going on. And maybe, you know, there's always criticism of the mainstream media, but maybe it was sometimes useful to have a common narrative in a democracy. So that's just my comment, and I would appreciate if you had any thoughts on that.
All right. Well, I will give you both of a chance, but let me I'll ask Helga. What do you think?
I do think that there is a way in which one can see that the increase in media kind of leads to fragmentation. We all read what we want to or listen to what we want to, but I don't think that that's necessarily the case. I think that we do tend to explore before we kind of get set into our ways. And I think that, you know, if you look at particularly in developing nations, and maybe not even so, you can even look at it in terms of in developing technologies, people do try things out before they kind of settle in into their sort of media diets, if you will, so that there is a kind of range of things. And I think that we do share, whether it's here in the U.S. or in other countries, there are overarching narratives that are present there, whether they're in the mainstream media or in other kinds of institutions, whether it's education or family or church or mosque or synagogue or whatever it is, so that I don't think that we're necessarily at risk in democracies or otherwise to lose any sense of cohesion because of technology.
You want to add anything on to that, Phil?
Yeah, I think this is a great question because I would have two answers. I would say that yes, new media are fragmenting, and this is probably a problem in democracies where you would want a strong public sphere and you would want to have some sense that most people are reading some kind of shared text. If you're getting your news from a news, if you're treating the NRA website as a news portal, that's probably a bad thing. So in that case, fragmentation is probably bad. In some of the developing world where the regime controls all the news, the fragmentation is probably good. It's probably good to have access to the BBC, CNN websites and not be so dependent on the state-run television and the state-run radio services.
Well, here we're talking about two different sorts of situations, and I take your point. I do find myself, though, wondering somewhat along the lines of what the caller said was about the arguments that said, well, when people get access to the Internet, it's a great thing because that means they have access to all of this kind of information and a broad range of political viewpoints. The suspicion I always had was, well, that may well be true, that people don't seek out viewpoints that differ from their own all that much, that what they're doing is they're collecting, and this is, I think we all do this all the time as we go through life. We accumulate little bits of information that confirm what it is we already believe, and we pass by the other stuff, and that it's probably no different when it comes to the Internet and the expansion of available information than it was before. And maybe that's just, we say, well, just human beings are like that, and they're going to be like that, and we really can't do anything about it.
Yeah, I think humans, I think people use the Internet a little bit for confirming stuff they want to have confirmed, and they also use it on occasion for challenging opinions they have. In countries that are emerging democracies or tough authoritarian regimes, many media users are not used to having conflicting opinions presented in op-ed pages or on differing websites. And so encountering this kind of content for the first time is a learning experience, and exciting for some and probably discomforting for others. But it's something that's part of the transition, I think, for many regimes in the developing world.
I do think that what ought to be sort of celebrated here is the fact that those differing opinions are actually more readily available with new technologies as opposed to previously, so that we may not seek them out, but they're there. Whereas if we still only had three TV channels, we would only have those three opinions as opposed to 300.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's talk with someone else. Here's a caller in Tolono community, not too far away. Line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Would your guest care to comment on the fact that China seems to have a more effective way of controlling the amount of information that either leaves the country and that comes into the country? So would any government would adopt, let's say, the Chinese model if they want to control information? I'll hang you up. Thank you.
And I suppose this does raise this larger question of how much control is it possible for a government to have? And can they truly have absolute control over what people can read and what sort of communications they can get to people outside of the country? Professor Howard, I don't know if you can say something about that.
Yeah, there's Internet traffic flows through exchange points. And in many countries, those exchange points sit in capital cities or port cities. And China's a good example because they've built in so much software and hardware infrastructure to try to maintain a Chinese internet that I would not be surprised that they monitor all the traffic, but I don't know that they regularly shut down access to the rest of the internet except in times of military or security crisis. There's only a few regimes in the world that do that regularly or have one internet. You might think of it as a choke point, a point in the infrastructure where the state can just turn off the exchange point and all the servers in country will be disconnected. And that's probably North Korea. That's probably the only regime that is so completely off the grid that they keep those choke points closed.
Well, if the government does indeed have control over the pipeline, so to speak, then if you want to control what people see, though, you don't have to turn the whole thing off. If you employ the right kind of filtering, then you can say to people, all right, you may look at these sites, but you may not look at these sites, and then that way you don't have to shut the tap off if you can determine what it is people can have access to.
Yes, and that's a good point, because the firms that design that kind of software are here in Silicon Valley. They're firms in California that specialize in providing regimes in the Middle East with the ability to censor content, and basically they'll say, provide us with a list of terms like labor union or social protest, and give us a list of these terms, and we'll put them on the list of things you can't search for in Saudi Arabia.
Can you, Professor Tewolsuri, I don't know if that's something you can talk about a little bit more specifically in the Middle East, what sort of things that governments can and have done to try to control the access that people have to particular kinds of information?
Yeah, I mean, it is unfortunately a kind of common experience across the Middle East that most media are controlled. Certainly, the internet is still it's not quite as bad as North Korea or China, but that you do have limited search capabilities. You're not allowed to, for example, you're not allowed to go to Israeli websites if you're in the UAE. If you're in the UAE or the United Arab Emirates, you're not allowed to search for, the word, any word that has, homosexual in it, or labor unions, or workers' rights, or a range of issues that are either politically or socially or religiously problematic for those governments. So that it is a kind of common experience. For example, when I was last in Abu Dhabi, I received a phone call from a friend in the Gaza Strip, and within a couple of seconds, the call was dropped because the phone number was blocked, because the Gaza Strip comes under the Israeli kind of foreign exchange, right? Hmm. So that's an example of the kinds of things that one experiences. But there is also a way in which you can circumvent that. If you install, Skype on your computer when you're outside of the country, and then you come in to, I'm picking on the UAE, but I could equally pick on a different Middle Eastern country, and then you come in to Dubai or Abu Dhabi, then you can actually Skype your friends in Israel if you wanted to. You can't do it if you install the software while you're there. So there are ways, as Dr. Howard said earlier, if you are technically savvy, there are ways to kind of get around a lot of these limitations.
Hmm. So I guess just the point you touched on just makes me want to underscore that we've been talking about the efforts of nations to control the kind of things that their people can see and read, and maybe your first assumption is that that's really all about politics, but it's not just about politics. I mean, there may be all sorts of things, things that have some sort of sexual content, for example, or, who knows, a lot of other things that for more social reasons rather than political reasons, they would say, no, we don't want to have people to have access to these kind of sites that deal with these kinds of subjects. And it's not always about politics.
No, I mean, I do think that oftentimes it is about, say, religion, right? Mm-hmm. Or sexuality, I think, is another kind of important one. So it's not just politics, you're right.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, I should just very quickly introduce our two guests talking with us by telephone. Helga Tewolsuri, she is Assistant Professor of Culture and Communication at New York University. Among the things she's interested in is media technologies and cultural expressions, especially contemporary media production in the Middle East. And she also is a photographer, a documentary filmmaker herself. She's interested in Arab and Palestinian broadcasting and in cinema. And also joining us by telephone is Philip Howard. He's associate professor in the Department of Communication at University of Washington, Seattle. He's also a fellow at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences at Stanford and has done a lot of writing about information technologies and what they meant for politics here in the United States. But he's also interested in how they're used to solve social problems in developing countries. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. And we'll go to somebody else here, Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. In your scenario that you started with, the idea that elite dissent is important in social change, I guess, for lack of a better word, in a repressive regime, it seems to me there's this conflict that if the onerous regime is supported by the West, you have a lot of forces that would that are in incredible conflict. I was just trying to figure out, or if a figure I heard about how much phone access there is in Iran. I think I heard something like 1 out of 6 actually have phone access, much less access to tweeting and everything else. I think I heard that when this poll that was done before the election that showed that there was a very good chance that Ahmadinejad would win. They used the lack of phone saturation of, as a criticism of the poll. But I don't know if you're understanding my major point is, and this may sound like a digression, but this is the 30th anniversary of the accession to power by Saddam Hussein, and it was the U.S. that helped him accede to power. So, I mean, a lot of people in the Middle East know that, but not a lot of Americans know that, it seems to me. So you have this westernization versus modernization sort of discourse that's here as well. And this is much too diffuse of a subject to bring up in the last 10 minutes, but it was bothering me a lot, so I tried. Mm-hmm. Could you respond to any of those points?
You know, I can't help but think of the example of Egypt, actually, when you were mentioning that oftentimes Western countries or the U.S. kind of support different kinds of dictatorships. And in Egypt, you do have kind of, you know, mini Facebook revolutions, if you will, where you do have groups of people, whether they're elites or not. I mean, it's almost moot at that point. You know, that gather and that try to sort of run protests and so on. But the politics in Egypt on a sort of very broad level don't change because Mubarak is supported by the U.S., and that's not really going to kind of change unless the U.S. changes its policy vis-a-vis Egypt. So that, you know, perhaps it's a bit too pessimistic or too cynical, but we can have sort of technological revolutions happening in a country, but if the powers that be, and in this case the U.S., and in this case, that's the U.S., don't want things to change, then they don't really have to necessarily.
Professor Howard, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, Dr. Talasur's example of Egypt is great, and they're supposed to have an election in the fall, I think. So if there's a country to watch over the next couple of months for this, to help us understand the interaction of technology diffusion and democratization, it'll be Egypt. I think there are many different ways that a country can democratize, and Egypt's actually a tough example because at the executive level, it seems very authoritarian. On the other hand, there are, as in Iran, there are local elections that aren't interfered with as much by the political apparatus, as much as the international press reports. And on the other hand, or on the third hand, you've got major political parties in Egypt that are simply banned and the Internet is their only forum for organizing and debating policy alternatives. So, yeah, Egypt's definitely a country to watch.
Interesting that Egypt has a system where to get on the ballot, you have to get a certain number of elected officials to sign on. And I don't know exactly which level of government that is. In Iran, you have to be approved by the mullahs, and here you have to be approved by the people that bankroll campaigns. So I just think that we have this typical American exceptionalism that our democracy is so healthy and other places are not. And I'm glad I can say what I can say in this country, but I think that there are limitations in the way discourse is presented here that are very problematic, and I'm glad that as much time is spent by this radio station on those problems, such as the show Media Matters, et cetera. Thanks a lot. Ring off.
Well, let's go on and talk to, we get at least one more caller here. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello. I have called in, I'm tuning in late, so this question may have already been answered, but I have a more of a technical question about how business transactions are done in those countries. One of the ones you mentioned was the UAE, but there are other countries. Business transactions are often encrypted, and there are also things called, the virtual private network concept, where you can set up encrypted networks. How do the governments of those countries deal with that kind of thing? I mean, it seems there's would be some kind of conflict because private business needs to be done, but they want to restrict content, and it seems like that would be an avenue by which groups could use, actually, to discuss forbidden topics. So I'll hang up and listen.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Yeah, you're right, and I do think that, I can't help but think that unless you're going to take the North Korean route, then once you do sort of allow any kind of technology, it becomes really difficult to completely kind of shut it out. But, I'm not sure about the technical aspects. I mean, I do think that a lot of these things are permissible, whether it's in the UAE or Egypt or elsewhere in the Middle East or elsewhere in the developing world. And there are also kind of zones of exception, and I think the UAE is sort of a primary example of that, where you have Internet City or Media City or I don't know what kind of other cities they have, where you have these sort of little areas that are kind of free, right, so that you don't pay taxes, your Internet access is kind of open to anything that you want. You can, in terms of Media City, you have all kinds of media that are there, working there, and they have complete sort of freedom of speech and so on, so that you do have kind of these zones of exceptions even within the kind of larger regimes, and that those are kind of no different than free trade zones, say in the Caribbean, right, or other kinds of examples that are kind of similar, so that it does allow for different groups to take advantage of those freedoms.
One thing that I'm interested in is to the extent to which if people in, say, in the Middle East or in Iran, someplace like that, are using services, say they're using Twitter, they're using Facebook, or they're using something like that, some kind of service where the host, the base, is outside of that country. Maybe it's in the United States, or maybe it's in Europe, maybe someplace else. To the extent to which those people and the people who operate those services experience pressure to limit the service or to turn it off or to something like that, and how it is they respond to that. And I guess I'm thinking about the famous, here again, example of Iran and people using Twitter. And it was said that the Obama administration said to the Twitter people, look, can you just make sure you don't limit anybody's access, and they continue to be able to use this. So are people who provide those services, do they face pressure from countries who want to limit access of their people to those services?
I think firms get diplomatic pressure whenever some content is on their networks. For example, I think it was 2 months ago that the brother of the ruler of the UAE, he had been making home digital videos of him torturing people by running over their hands with his SUV, and somebody hacked it, got into his cell phone and uploaded these videos and put them on YouTube. And so it caused a diplomatic row, but part of the row involved the Crown Prince asking YouTube to remove the content. And I don't think, because the firm is based in the U.S., I don't think they need to succumb to that kind of diplomatic pressure. In the United States, it's back to the encryption point. In the United States, there are rules about the level of encryption you can sell to companies overseas. So I suspect that they people in the developing world can buy good encryption, but not great encryption.
I mean, those same firms, for example, are in some cases not allowed, as Dr. Howard just said, not allowed to sell certain kinds of things to different countries. There's also a way in which, for example, you know, you can't get the kind of latest router if you live in Syria because I don't know, or Oracle, or not Oracle, but I can't think of the name of the firm right now, but it's not allowed to sell those kinds of routers to Syria. So there are ways in which you know, our own politics here in the U.S. kind of prevent companies from, if you will, from allowing full democratization to happen, because without the freedom to kind of access the Internet, then what is it that we really expect out of, in this case, Syria?
Yeah. Well, we're at the point where we're going to have to finish, and I realize that our conversation has been a little loose and rambly. I guess I wonder, though, on this subject, I'll give each of you a quick chance to say, give us a sort of a last thought to leave us with. We'll start with Helga. How about that?
I think that in general, technologies are a wonderful thing, and we can't sort of forget that. There are many sort of hidden beasts, if you will, sort of behind them and within them, right? That they're not simply in and of themselves tools that can allow for democratization, but it's what we do with them. It's also who controls them, not simply the governments in questions, but the firms, the kinds of architecture that are there, and the technologies. Who stands to benefit from technological development economically as well is another kind of sort of powerful impact that we haven't really discussed. On the other hand, I do think that it's wonderful to kind of see the expansion of technology across different regimes and across developing nations, and that we still have a kind of a long ways to go for everybody to be involved in the Internet age, if you will.
Well, I tell you what, we're going to have to stop there. I'll have to give you the last word because we're here at the end of the time. I want to thank Howard Philip Howard, Associate Professor in the Department of Communication, University of Washington, Seattle. Thank you very much for giving us some of your time.
Of course.
And Helga Tawassuri, Assistant Professor of Culture and Communication in the Department of Media, Culture and Communication at New York University. Thank you very much.
Thank you.